for the idol worship?
Well, yeah, but not really. They were exiled with the exile of the 10 tribes, and the reason for that whole exile was because of idol worship.
Because of their idol worship?
Because of their idol worship. So they were punished. Although it's interesting, I don't think there's any indication that they were punished to a greater extent than the other 10 tribes. See, all the 10 tribes followed their lead. But they were punished, but I don't believe they were singled out for punishment. But that's done. Now, there is this amazing story about Michna. Remember, this idolatrous thing gets associated with Dun, although Dun was not the originator of it. The originator of it was Micha. And Micha, not to be confused with the prophet Micha, Micha was not from the tribe of Dun. Micha was from Shechet Ephraim. Yeah, Mihar Ephraim. He was a man from Ephraim. The only thing is that essentially Shevet Dun stole his idol. Remember, Shevet Dun is passing through to conquer Laish, and they simply take his idol, and they take the Levi and everything else, and Levi is Moshe Rabbeinu's grandson. Alright, but in either event, there is a medrash that says this, an amazing medrash. The medrash says that Micha is also an old fellow. Micha was around all the way back when Moshe Rabbeinu, if you remember in Yetzias Mitzrayim, during the slavery in Egypt, when Paro became a leper. Remember, it says in the pasuk, "Vayomas Melech Mitzrayim," the king of Egypt died. "Vayayonchu b'nei Yisrael min ha'avayda," and they cried out, they groaned from the work, and they called out to God. So, according to Rashi, it doesn't mean that the king of Egypt died, but it means the king of Egypt became a metzora. He became a leper, because leprosy is treated as death. And he was told by his physicians that the only way he could cure himself is by killing the babies, Jewish babies, and washing in their blood. Now, it's interesting that the Gra points out, how did Chazal know that Vayamas doesn't mean literally? It says he died. So he says, the Vilna Gaon says a very interesting point, which is borne out. He says, we never refer to a person's title when they die. It never says, Vayamas Melech David, the king died, because of the pasuk in Kohelis that says, Ein Shiltan B'yom HaMavis. The day that someone dies, you don't have any authority, you know, you don't have any rulership that day. So if it says, not Vayamas Paro, but it says, Vayamas Melech Mitzrayim, it must be that he physically was still alive and he became a Mitzrayim. Now, the Abarbanel makes another point, also a very big point. What does the pasuk say? This king got leprosy, according to the rabbinic interpretation. He is slaughtering Jewish babies. And what does the pasuk say bothered the Jews? V'yayonchu b'nei Yisrael min ha'avoda. The work of schlepping the corpses of the babies was too hard for them. In other words, this is the level of dehumanization that you reach, that when one's children are being murdered, the only thing you think about is, another thing I have to do. I have to carry this load and this burden. And that's when it says, Vatal Shavasam El Elokim. Their cry went up to God. So the Or HaChaim says, all of those fits together, that it doesn't mean they prayed to God. Rather, their screams of agony and dehumanization reached God. So it doesn't say they prayed to Hashem. It says their screams went up to God. That's a different connotation. Okay, but in either event, there is a story that Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was still in Pyro's house before he killed the Mitzri, once walked by, and at another time, the Egyptians used to put, would instruct the Jews to throw the Jewish bodies into the bricks to be mortar for the bricks. So Moshe saw a baby who was trapped in the mortar. And Moshe used the divine name of God to free the baby. And according to Chazal, this baby was this Micha. And when Micha grew up, Micha was somehow in possession of the shame, the name of God that Moshe had used, and Micha used it to create the idol. So in effect, it's a very interesting shidduch that Micha's Kohen, Ersatz Kohen, would be the grandson of Moshe. Because in effect, Micha got his ability to create the idol from the name that Moshe Rabbeinu used to liberate him from the bricks. said.
I didn't understand the last part that we said. I mean, I understand about the mikvah, and then you said, so who is the kohen?
Now, the pasuk says, we learned last week that the kohen that Micha enlisted to serve was a grandson of Moshe Rabbeinu.
So isn't it in a way that maybe you're not supposed to tamper with a kaddish baruch hu? Oh, I don't know.
Well, there is a problem. They have this famous, they have this story I read. It's a famous little story that they always have in kids' magazines about a doctor that's called in to cure a baby, and the baby's dying and writhing in agony. And the good doctor, you know, spends hours and hours, you know, helping the baby and bringing the baby and bring the baby to life. And everyone is so grateful, you know, and the baby is Adolf Hitler, you know.
Yeah.
That type of thing. So there is, you never know. Obviously, you're supposed to try to save life.
Yeah,
we never know the consequences of what goes on.
The Medrash comes up that he's this person, not a good one, you know.
Yeah. And besides, though, Micha himself is not unequivocally repudiated. I mean, Chazal praised Micha's hospitality, his generosity, and they basically blame his mother for getting him into idol worship. In other words, if anything, the character flaw that we see is an unwillingness to stand up to his mother. In other words, he initially stole the money. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay. He initially stole the money, and some say he stole the money precisely because he didn't want his mother to get involved in idolatry. But then he gives it back. So some have seen in Micha not the personality of the idol worshiper, but the personality of the son who's too good, too generous, too kind to his mother, too forgiving. But then you have other statements in Chazal that seem to talk about him as the unrequited evildoer, the one who was evil in Mitzrayim, the one who in the middle of Kriyas Yamsuf was holding on to this idol. Although again, I don't know how you reconcile it with the account that this was something that was made much later. So you see that, as is true in many situations, the Midrashim are not fully consistent, and different Midrashim portray the personality in a different way. But again, yeah.
Can I ask you a question? If in fact this idol was created earlier on, then there would have been no need for Nagel HaZahav. They would have had something in addition.
Well, that's a good point. That's why I think that you have to interpret when you see a phrase that says the Pesel Micha was carried with them. I think it must refer to the predisposition towards idolatry. It does not refer to an actual idol. I mean, the Pasuk in Shoftim says, he made an idol at this point. But once again, this is described as a time of Ish Kol HaYashar B'Einav, when there was no authority. This is even before. Remember, you have to keep in mind that although this is the end of the book of Shoftim, this occurred before there was even a Shofet, between the death of Yoshua and the designation of Asniel ben Kenaz. The Jewish people are being ruled by a king of Syria, Kushan Rishasayim. And during Kushan Rishasayim, this particular thing of Pesel Micha happens. Remember, too, that you have to understand this story in retrospect. Shmuel is writing this. And in Shmuel's time, there is already a well-established temple to idolatry in the tribe of Dan. And Shmuel is trying to describe, give you a backwards glance, and say, you know how this started? This started from a fellow Micha, etc. He's going backwards and giving you the origins, because this was a block. This was a well-established temple to idolatry that existed all the days that the Mishkan of Hashem was in Shiloh, until the destruction of Shiloh. And according to another pshat, again, if you recall, there were two different timing provisions here. One pasuk said the idol existed all the days the Mishkan was in Shiloh. And another says that Moshe Rabbeinu's family were the Kohanim to this idol, Ad Galos Ha'aretz, until the exile of the land, which seems to be the exile of the 10 tribes, which is many hundreds of years after the discussion of the Mishkan and Shiloh. So some say that the temple in Dan, the particular Pesel Micha, only lasted until the destruction of Shiloh, but there were still other Avodah Zarah that Moshe Rabbeinu's family was involved in. Others say that Galos Ha'aretz refers to the capture of the Ark, in other words, the Mishkan of Shiloh. In other words, everything terminated. This was not something that lasted beyond that relatively short time. Okay, so that is the story of Pesel Micha. Now, the next story is even more disturbing, because if the first story illustrates that Jewish people, that a segment of the Jewish people are over the Avodah Zarah, which is one thing, but now we're going to see, in addition, there was a murder, there was rape, and indeed a whole tribe of Israel almost got wiped out entirely. And this is the story of the Pelegesh Begiva. the Pilegesh, the concubine, who died in Giva. Giva is a town in the district of Binyamin. It is around Yerushalayim, right? Binyamin has the area directly north. If you remember, Yerushalayim southward is essentially the land that was given to Shevet Yehuda. And part of Yerushalayim and south was the land that was given to Binyamin. So Giva is a town that is north of Yerushalayim, and as we will see, it is fairly near Yericho. So if you have a sense of where Yericho is, you go north along the Jordan. Giva is a bit more away. It's west of the west of Yericho. So the pasuk tells us again. This is now Perek Yud Tes. And again, the reason we're doing this is because these events occurred at the very beginning of the period of the Shoftim. Vahi b'yamin mohen. It was in those days once again. U'melech ein b'Yisrael. There was no king in Israel. Again, to illustrate that there was lawlessness and no control. So we have a story once again involving a Levi. Vayihi ish Levi. There was a Levi, Gor b'Yarkasei Har Ephraim, who lived in the Mount Ephraim area. Again, if you keep in mind the map, you have Yehuda, Binyamin, north of Binyamin, around the center of the country. The hilly part of the country is called Har Ephraim. Har Ephraim is not it's not just one mountain. Har is used to mean the mountainous, hilly areas. Remember, a Levi didn't have their own land, so the different Shvatim gave Arei Leviim. We read it yesterday. There are 48 cities that were designated for the Leviim. Six of them are the cities of refuge, the Ir Miklat, and the other 42 are the regular cities. So he's a Levi who came from Ephraim. Vayikach lo isha pilegesh. And he took a woman. Pilegesh is a word meaning a concubine. I'll explain that in a second. And she came from a family, Beis Lechem, right? Bethlehem, where Kever Rachel is, Yehuda. Because Beis Lechem is in the portion that was given to the tribe of Yehuda. It is south of Yerushalayim. Yeah, I could spend just a few words on what a Pilegesh is. It's an interesting point. We find in the Torah, throughout the Torah, we find Nashim, and Nach especially, Nashim, like it says, David took Nashim, David took wives, Upilagshim, and he took, we say, concubines. So what is a Pilegesh? So actually there is a very big machlokas among the Rishonim, among the early commentators. What is the nature of a Pilegesh? One interpretation is a Pilegesh is indeed a mistress, a woman that one is not married to. We'll discuss in a moment whether that's permitted and why is it permitted. The other interpretation is a Pilegesh is a married woman. Now she's married to you, married to the man, but there's no kesuva. Normally when you marry a woman, a husband undertakes certain obligations that are spelled out in a kesuva, that in the event of death or divorce, she will get financial settlement and the like. So a Pilegesh is simply a woman who agreed to be married and has foregone her kesuva. She's agreed. A woman cannot be a Pilegesh against her will, but if she wants to marry the guy and the guy says, I'm marrying you on the condition that I don't owe you anything, so that's a Pilegesh. So, a Pilegesh is either an Eishes Ish, she's either married or not married. Now most Rishonim actually learn that Pilegesh is not married at all. In other words, a concubine or a mistress. Now the question is a Pilegesh going to be permitted? So actually, there are Rishonim, the Ramban, and other Rishonim that say Pilegesh is permitted. Where does the Torah say? Actually, it's one of those things where you don't necessarily want to announce it publicly from the pulpit. But where does the Torah say specifically that a man is not allowed to be with an unmarried woman? It's hard to identify an exact pasuk. The Torah talks about the arayos, the forbidden incestuous relationships. There is, of course, a prohibition to be with a nida. If a single woman didn't go to the mikveh, of course that's going to be usur. But remember, you have to remember one other thing just about mikveh in a second, that although it's our custom today universally that single women do not go to the mikveh, that was absolutely not the case in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, where single women who menstruated had to go to the mikveh. And the reason is very simple. Because a nida is not only a question of being forbidden with her husband, but a nida is tameh. If she were to touch truma or korbanos, they would become tameh. Now when you had a Beis HaMikdash, and the nida was handling food that had to be sanctified, she had to go to the mikveh not to make it tameh. So it was absolutely the case that women went to the mikveh every month. Today, where all of us are considered tamei already, because all of us have been in a cemetery or whatever, so all of us are tamei. The only way we can become tahor is with the ashes of the parah aduma. So, in terms of tuma, there is no reason for a woman, or for a man for that matter, to go to the mikveh. It's only because of the husband, marital relations, so a single woman doesn't go to the mikveh. But certainly, that was the case, and with some mikdash, in the time people went.
Did the man go to the mikveh?
Yeah. The man mission, whether it was in intercourse or separately, is tamei for that day, and truma, or touch truma, or kutchim, sanctified things, he had to go to the mikveh. So, the mikveh is a much more common thing, in other words, that's why you find, you know, there were many mikvahs in communities. It wasn't like, you know,
built. The entrance to the Beit HaMikdash, they have.
Right, they have all those mikvahs there.
Because, I guess, before people went in.
Right, right. In fact, there's a general rule. Before you enter the Beit HaMikdash, you have to go to the mikvah. And that's even if you're ritually pure. In those days, mikvahs were not like, you know, the million community projects. So, you know, you had a mikvah. There were mikvahs all over the place. Every house had a mikvah. You needed it. You needed it because in daily food preparation, you had to be in a state of purity very often. But neither of them. So the question is this. The question is, once again, is there anything in the Torah that prohibits premarital relations, assuming that the woman has gone to the mikveh? Right? Is there anything? All right, so there is an argument here. So the Rambam says like this. The Rambam says, or the Ramban actually says that as long as the woman is committed, as long as there is a committed and stable relationship, not a promiscuous one, it's not like a prostitute that will be with many, many people. There are shitos that say that a pilegish is muter if she is what we call, muteris, if she is what we call a miyuchedes lo. Miyuchedes lo means someone who is exclusively involved with a certain person and is not promiscuous.
Exclusive just from her point, because he could have other.
That's correct. Exclusivity would mean from the woman's point, right? Because he could have other relationships.
Would she be wanting to ultimately, if they split up?
Yeah. Remember, keep in mind another thing: that a woman that had relations before marriage is allowed to marry a kohen as long as it wasn't with a non-Jew. A woman does not become forbidden to a kohen just by having relations. It's having relations with a non-Jew that is a problem.
What about Tolomelech? He's not allowed to take someone who's been with him. And the question here also, aren't there some chachamim who say only with a king?
No, that's the next thing. So that's one school of thought.
The Ramban says that to
the Ramban. Yeah, some say the Ramban. This was a forged opinion of the Ramban. Again, there's an argument exactly. This is quoted in the name of the Ramban. In the Chuvas Ramban, the response of the Ramban. There is even a statement where he advised somebody to take a pilegish.
These are married guys?
Yeah. Keep in mind that under the original Torah law, a married person, man, could have more than one wife. So the chiddush is, even a pilegish is okay, as long as she's miyuchedes for him. Miyuchedes
like,
meaning exclusively.
Yeah, like a common law wife.
Right.
It's like a common law wife.
Now,
there
are other opinions that say this. There are other opinions that say that Pilegesh is a special dispensation for a king. It is clear that a melech is allowed to have a Pilegesh, but a hedyot meaning a person who is not a melech, is not allowed to have a Pilegesh. And the Rambam actually depends. The Rambam says the following. The Rambam, Maimonides, says this phrase, Kol ha-boel isha l'shem znus. Anyone that has relationships with women in a promiscuous manner has transgressed a negative commandment. So some say, however, promiscuous manner means that if she's miyuchedes, the Rambam would say it is permitted. Others say, the Rambam says, anytime there's no marriage, that is called l'shem znus and is prohibited. So essentially there's an argument how to interpret the Rambam's position with the key words l'shem. The shame's nuts.
Would it take a pilegish financial reason? I mean, because let's say if she's miyuchedet and they do it halachically, why wouldn't he give her a ketubah?
Financial reasons. That's exactly it. There'd be financial reasons. Of course, the children you have from a pilegish are heirs. I mean, they would have to share in the estates. But at least in terms of the woman, you wouldn't have an obligation to support her. Mm-hmm. There could be different things. So this is a machlekes if a pilegish is permitted to a hedyot or not. Also, Pilegesh is a way that a melech could circumvent. A melech is not allowed to have more than 18 wives.
But that included the Pilegesh.
Well, some say if it's a Pilegesh, he could go beyond it.
David had combined Pilegesh and wife count.
Well, David had six wives.
Six in Chevron.
No, but some say that would have meant that he would have been allowed to have up to 18 wives. He didn't have 18 wives. Hashem says he would be allowed to have had up to 18.
If the issue of Pilegesh arises because of financial reasons, and we're saying that this really relates exclusively to a king, you would think that a king wouldn't have a financial problem.
Well, you know, sometimes the rich people are rich because they know how to. I think J. Paul Getty, I heard, put a payphone in his house. People would come in here. So things like that. But anyway, so again, now here we have a reference that this woman is a Pilegesh. Now, obviously, if we learn that a Pilegesh is only permitted to a melech, then this would have been a prohibited relationship. Prohibited, but nevertheless, it's still a relationship. People did averus, and we're going to see worse averus that were done than this. If we see, on the other hand, Pilegesh is permitted to a hetzot, then this would be permitted. Now again, obviously, in light of the many, many teachings about the importance of marriage and the chashivas of marriage, the holiness of marriage, obviously nobody says Pilegesh is desirable. Even if it's permitted, no one claims that it's desirable. But it's interesting that the Pilegesh solution, or the Pilegesh idea, was actually advocated in the 19th century in Morocco to solve an aguna problem. The aguna issue is the problem of women who get married whose husbands refuse to give them a religious divorce. So it's very difficult because Beis Din can never dissolve a marriage. Beis Din can order a husband to give a get, but if the husband doesn't give the get, the woman is in a lot of trouble. So the women in that predicament are in that predicament, but it was suggested by two rabbanim in Morocco that maybe we ought to abolish marriage. Maybe we ought to do this. Maybe, since we never know whether a husband might turn out to be recalcitrant or evil or spiteful, maybe we ought to have a situation where all ceremonies would essentially involve creating a relationship of Pilegesh, coupled with a supplementary agreement that you will agree, because a person could agree to support his mistress. In other words, see, a husband is obligated to support one's wife. A man is not obligated to support a Pilegesh, but he could enter into an agreement. So let's create Pilegesh with an agreement to support. And the advantage of it is that if he ever abandons her, she does not need a get, because she's not married, and you don't need a get. And this way, if we abolish marriage, people can have children, and there'd be support obligations, but there would never be an issue of iguna. So this was suggested by two rabbis, but they mentioned that they were not suggesting this for practical implementation, only if other people would agree with them. It's common in certain controversial psukim, you say that this psak shall be valid only if other people agree. Nobody else agreed. It was considered to be your remedy is worse than the problem. I mean, aguna is a tragic problem, but it is a relatively small proportion of cases. So to say that because of 1% of the cases that turn out very, very bad, we should just get rid of marriage was thought to be a little bit extreme.
Is it really that high,
1%? I mean, the cases are very sad. I don't mean to demean any of the cases, right, but it's not a very high percentage. It is a relatively small percentage.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's right, because once she's married, a married woman cannot have relations with anyone other than her husband, whether it's...
She has to get a get.
So what do you do? I mean, in Eretz Yisrael, if a Beis Din orders a husband to give a get, and he refuses to give a get, he could be thrown in jail, because the Beit Din Rabbani is part of the governance system. But even so, that's 30 years. There was a Time magazine had a story about a fellow who was in jail for 30 years for not giving his wife a get. So what do you do? And America is even worse, because in America we don't even have that authority. A judge will not throw you in jail, throw a man in jail for not giving a get to his wife.
What about the RCA?
So the RCA, you have prenuptial agreements where the person agrees to pay a certain amount of money while his wife doesn't have a get. You know, that could work, but that could work in some cases.
But the truth is, the RCA can't write in that a man agrees to give a get?
No. That's the one thing you can't do, because you can never force a person to give a get unless there are certain defined conditions.
So it's only, they're only right in that you have to give her a certain amount of
money?
Right.
So the concept is, if his choice is pay money or give a get, you hope he'll give a get. The problem is, of course, that if you've ever, I hope you know, you've never encountered this, but if you've ever encountered people with that attitude, you know, people are acting out of spite, so, you know, money, that doesn't bother them. I mean, there are people who are in jail. If somebody's willing to stay in jail for 30 years, then money. And besides, if somebody doesn't have the money, somebody conceals money. Money is not a difficult thing to conceal. You can get judgments against somebody for $10 million. If they say they don't have it, so it's going to be a little difficult to prove that they do have it.
If somebody's willing to sit in jail for 30 years, can't that be looked at as a form of insanity?
That's an argument, okay, maybe. We're very strict, because since if a woman marries without a get, the kids would be mamzerim and everything else.
Right.
So we're very strict. I mean, we can't, you know. I mean, it's possible, but you know, we wouldn't just like make up something or say, oh, he must be crazy.
The thing is that kind of vindictiveness is really borders on madness.
I'll tell you your problem. Your argument will actually make things worse, because I'll tell you why. Because even if you're going to say that if the guy was in jail for 30 years, he must be crazy. When did he become crazy? Was he crazy when he married her? Or did he become crazy later? If he became crazy later, that's a much worse situation, because a man who becomes crazy after marriage might get his wife. See, your argument would make sense only if, because he's not mentally competent. Your argument would only be true. See, if you could establish he was mentally deranged when he married her, then you have a good argument, because the marriage would not have been valid. But if all you can establish is he became crazy 5 years later, you're in a lot of trouble, because she's very much stuck.
What if you get hold of one or two people who knew him when he was single and can attest to that he did weird things?
Okay, I mean, those are relevant. Those are relevant things. Yeah. Those are very relevant issues. You go we do know, of course, we have the famous Pesach of Rav Moshe Feinstein, which has helped in many cases, although not in all cases. Where, you know, the problem that arises very often is not so much aguna. The problem is that very often women who are not familiar with the religious law just got married after a civil divorce, and they have kids from a second marriage. And technically, since she was not divorced from her first marriage, the kids from the second marriage are mamzerim. They are born from adultery, and a mamzer cannot marry other Jews. And what you have is, sometimes these kids grow up and they want to become religious, and they want to stay Reformed, so they don't care either. But I've had a number of cases, again, as your father's, I was involved with your father in this, where you have people who, 30 years after their mother remarried, and they were born from a second marriage, they want their Bali Tshuva, and then they discover they might be Mamzerim. And Rav Moshe's Psak always was that if the initial marriage, for which a get was not given, was not a kosher marriage, you didn't have kosher witnesses, so Rav Moshe says, well, they weren't married. If they weren't married, they didn't need a get. And therefore, the second marriage is a valid marriage. But the problem is, this was Rav Moshe's Psak. The many Gedolim in Eretz Yisrael do not accept that reasoning, and they want to be strict. So it's a very big problem. With Rav Moshe gone, the younger people in America are unwilling to kind of say this, because they don't have Rav Moshe's stature. And the senior Gedolim in Eretz Yisrael don't like that Psak at all. So it's a difficult situation for people right now. Well, no, because granting, Mamzeris is one problem, but even if there's not a problem of Mamzeris, it's adultery. The woman is committing adultery. If a woman does not have a get...
Over 40 can still have kids.
Whatever, even if... No, no, whatever. Even if... Even if adultery, even if moms, even if children are totally out of the question. But adultery is a tremendous avera. Can't commit adultery.
I don't have children until I'm age 95.
No, not really, but...
No, but even the normal way. But,
everybody has a lot of people have
children. Well, the truth is, with in vitro and other methods, women could bear children even after menopause, I believe, with the technology
somebody
today.
Did, yeah.
Did someone actually do that?
Yes.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
people that have regular children.
No,
it was in vitro.
No, but in vitro, yeah.
Yeah.
No, but even, I mean, apparently at 7, it hasn't been done yet, but apparently at any age. In other words, with an in vitro system, it would be possible to have it at any age. Yeah. So anyway, so as I say that, this was kind of a dramatic use of this notion of pilegesh to try to get around the problem of aguna. But anyway, so we are told that this Levi took a woman that was a Pilegesh. Now, there's a little bit of a problem here. And I mentioned that some Rishonim say that Pilegesh actually means a married woman without a ksuba. But most Rishonim say Pilegesh means not married at all. Because we will find that her father is referred to as this Levi's Chosein. Chosein is father-in-law, which seems to be a term that you use only for a marriage. It's a little difficult if Pilegesh means there's no marriage, but you could say that because they do have an exclusivity relationship, so we can also call her father as a father-in-law. Yeah.
Do you think with this institution of Pilegesh there were no single older women? Because then they could say, rather than be single, they wouldn't mind being a Pilegesh.
So yeah, that makes a lot of sense. In other words, it was a way where...
It makes sense. I'll take it otherwise, as long as I don't have to be responsible for her financially. And
that makes sense. In other words, it could have been a way to ensure universal... that women
security
would be taken care of on some level.
Especially since they couldn't work in those days and they were...
Yeah,
right.
I think that makes sense. That probably was it. It probably was it.
But they were in a home.
They were in a home. In other words, even if there was no obligation, but yeah.
There's
absolutely no obligation. Like I know that when the ketubah is not only the financial thing. Ketubah is also a man who has to...
Yeah,
you don't have to have a relationship with his wife.
Yeah.
Right, but they have to also fulfill his obligation with
the mistress. No, in fact, but keep in mind too that although I used the word mistress, it was not a mistress in the sense of some hidden away thing. I mean, this was someone who lived in the home and was known to the wives. So this was someone that was part of the household.
But he was not permitted to mistreat her. I mean, if she lived there, didn't he have to feed? I mean, there was no ksuba.
Whatever was agreed upon. In other words, she was brought in on certain terms. She could negotiate for the terms. Yeah. A woman could not be a Pilegesh against her will. This was something she agreed to do. And they had a private contract. There was no halachically mandated agreement. The agreement took whatever form they wanted it to take.
So she could basically have all the
she could leave when she wanted. That's right.
Except
in fact, if somebody wanted to marry her, she could. She could go marry. Yeah. This is domestic partnership. A true domestic. Yeah.
She could
leave. Yeah. Now the problem is when you're a Pilegesh of a Melech, things are a little different. If you're a Pilegesh of a Melech, you couldn't leave because a Pilegesh of a Melech could not marry anyone else.
But it's making it seem more like Znud, and I don't think, isn't the input and the intent of the Chachamim with the Pilegesh not to be, hey, I'll go from in bed to bed. It's a you're miyuchedet lo. I mean, it's not that you could just pick up and pull out.
No, that's right.
Feel
but,
like it.
Well.
I mean, I can't,
what was her commitment? Did she have to stay?
Well, first of all, it's societal, too. I mean, today's society, you could hop from place to place, but in the society in which the Pilegesh was taken wasn't a society in which that was condoned. I mean, I think it was, once you took a Pilegesh, it was like when they meant miyuchedet lo. They meant just like marriage. I think that was the intent of the Chachamim, because they would. We have the concept of kedoshim to you, and the kedesha is not allowed. This is not legalized prostitution. And if I think that that would be against the import, the intent of the Chachamim when they said those who says she was only miyuchedet, that it could be with anyone. Because you said most of the Chachamim feel that it's only for a melech. The rest, the way I understood it, unless I understood
it. No, the rest say that it's also.
The rest say that the ksuba, most of them say that it's for the melech, that state of pilegish without mm-hmm. part of a marriage, mm-hmm. without part of a marriage ceremony, without most of the marriage ceremony, is basically to a king. It was only mm-hmm. the minority who would say that any head yod could take it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's we're coming out with a misconception here, I think, that it's not...
Well, we're switching gears. I mean, in other words, the questions that are being raised are like the opinions that permit the pilegish magic.
But most...
Well, in the Rambam, most opinions in the Rambam say a pilegish is permitted only for a melech, so the whole issue in the private sector would not arise. But they were asking questions based on the other opinion.
But it would make it seem that was a prevalent accepted opinion, and it almost be in legalized prostitution. I don't think that's...
Well, if a pilegish is mutter to a hedget, you have that intimation, although she does have to be miyuchedah, she can't be promiscuous at the time. In fact, I see here that they quote Rabbeinu Avram ben HaRambam, the Rambam's son, who was a great person in his own right, who does say that the relationship of the Levi to this Pilegesh was in fact a sinful relationship. This itself was a chait, based on the reading that a Pilegesh is only permitted to a melech. Okay, now then, Pasuk Bey says, Vatizna olav pilaksho. Now, the word tizna, which comes from zanus, literally means she turned away from him. Zana is to turn away, but, it's commonly used to refer to committing adultery. She committed zanus. Now, this is an interesting question. You know, if a married woman, not raped, but if she voluntarily commits adultery while she's married, the halacha is she is not allowed to stay married to her husband. She must be sent away. She must be divorced. In fact, there are three people to whom an adulterous woman cannot marry. She cannot stay married to her husband. She cannot marry the guy that she was with. And she cannot marry a kohen. That's a separate halakha. But she could marry anybody else. I mean, she's not restricted from marrying. So this is only... Huh?
You're not killed for his note?
Well, if there were witnesses, I mean, there are all sorts of rules. There have to be witnesses who warned you. But let's say even today, where we don't have dinin nefashos, we don't have capital punishment, she's still forbidden to stay married to her husband.
To her husband, to a kohen, and to his husband.
And to the guy that she was with, to the
boel,
that she committed adultery with. Which is really a problem, by the way, if you think about it. This is a serious halakhic problem with women who marry second husbands before they get a get. And then they want to do tshuva, and they get a get later. They get a get later, etc., and everything's fine, and they don't have kids. There's no mamzeris issue. The question is, are they allowed to stay married to the guy that they married? Because they married him before they got a get, so they committed adultery. But some say that wouldn't be a problem, because they say, if the woman thought she was no longer married to her first husband, because she thought a civil divorce was all she needed, then, in effect, some would say we don't treat her as a willing committer of adultery, only an unintentional committer of adultery. And that would not answer her.
Well, why doesn't that work for mamzerim?
Because mamzerim applies even to rape and lack of intent. In other words, mamzer does not depend on intent. Mamzer depends on fact. Mm-hmm. If there was an intercourse that was adulterous, whether the person knew it or didn't know it, whether it was volitional or coercive, child is a mamzer, so it doesn't help for mamzer. But in terms of being forbidden to be with the guy that she married, that depends on intent, etc. Well, that gets us into a whole other discussion, but generally speaking, there is no automatic rule. Generally speaking, this is always an inconsistency with the Republican pro-life. They say, we're against abortion because the fetus is life, except when there's rape or incest. Well, why is it the fault of the fetus that there's rape or incest? I mean, if the fetus is a person. So halacha would say this. Halacha would say that the ultimate heter of abortion is whether the mother's life is threatened by the pregnancy. Now, threatening of life can be in a number of ways. It could be through the physical danger, or there could be very severe psychological trauma, and this would be on a case-by-case basis. So some women, this would not involve a case of psychological pikuach nefesh. For other women, yes. So the issue is not rape or incest. The issue is, what is the impact of this on the person? I know of a story where a religious woman was raped, and she became pregnant with twins. And the trauma was so great, she was very close to suicide. She wanted to kill herself. And she talked to Rav Moshe Feinstein, and Moshe Feinstein told her, he urged her to carry the babies to term. He said, these are Jewish children, and they deserve a chance to live. It's not, you know, it's not their fault. And the story goes, she raised the kids, and they became religious, and got smicha, became rabbis, and got married. So,
married at the month.
No, she was single.
She was a single.
She is single. But even, she was single. I'm sorry. But one second. But let's say they were okay. But let's say they were married. Let's say they were mamzer. So, I mean, you know, a mamzer is entitled to live too. You know, a mamzer, number one, a mamzer could marry a gioris, by the way. But besides that,
what's the status of the children?
They're children. Yeah, it goes on forever. The only way you can remove the taint of mamzer is by committing the sin of intermarriage, which means if a male mamzer were to marry a non-Jewish woman, not a converted woman, a non-Jewish woman, she's not allowed to do, the child would be a goy. And if the goy converts, there's no mamzerus. That is the only way. But you're not allowed to pursue that way. So.
But it isn't a marriage. But what if he just sleeps with her?
Same thing.
If he just sleep, he could sleep with her.
Well, there's no marriage. Yeah, there's no marriage.
And then marry her afterwards.
But if they're girls, there's
nothing. No, he's not allowed to sleep with her either.
I know.
All right. So there are ways. Now, but the point is, you know, a mamzer. Okay, so a mamzer has some very severe disabilities, but still, I mean.
But why wouldn't it be logical to just give the RU 482 pill the day after a rape, or before you even know that there's a pregnancy?
But if you're doing something that's terminated pregnancy, you have an abortion problem. I mean, you're doing something that only works as a terminator of pregnancy. Now, there is a svar from Rav Yaakov Emden. Rav Yaakov Emden says a chiddush like this. Rav Yaakov Emden, who is kind of a gadfly, and well, a very great halachic authority, says that if a woman voluntarily commits adultery and conceives, you're allowed to abort. And his reasoning is this. When a person commits adultery, they're chayav misa. In the time of the Beis HaMikdash, they could be executed. Now, the Mishnah says if a woman was pregnant, she would be executed anyway, because you can kill the child along. So therefore, since she deserves to die, and if she were to die, the fetus would die with her, so she can kill the fetus, because that's what would have happened anyway. But that ironically, that logic only holds true for adultery and not for rape. Although we would tend to look at it the opposite way, because for rape, she would not be chayev misa, chayev es misa, and therefore you couldn't. Okay. But anyway, the question I want to raise is this. If we interpret Vatizna alav pilakshel as she had an affair with somebody else, the question would be, would she then be allowed to go back to the Levi? In other words, we're going to find that she did this and she ran away, and the Levi tries to bring her back. So here, once again, we have a comment from Rav Avram ben Harambam that says that because a pilagesh is not a marital relationship, even though it's supposed to be exclusive and not promiscuous, her momentary lapse, as it were, would not forbid her to go back to her husband. In other words, or not her husband, but the man. But he does say, what is his lashon? He has a lashon here that says, pritzasi. It's not a moral thing for him to take her back. Afal pi shlo nesra alav bezanusa lefi diktuka halacha. Although, according to the strict letter of the law, she would not become prohibited to him.
You just gave validation. You gave a reason why a woman would opt to be pilegish rather than a wife if she were sort of loose.
But again, I mean that institution is not permitted. But anyway, according to the Rambam, having a pilegish for a non-melech is forbidden anyway. So it's already been. But he makes the point that even the taking her back was something that was not totally right. Now, this is assuming that Vatizna refers to its typical meaning, which is znus, right? But the Gemara in Gittin actually gives a different meaning. The Gemara in Gittin says, Vatisna means she ran away from him. Just means she ran away. There's no znus over here. And why did she run away? So the Gemara basically says, the Gemara has a whole discussion in Gittin about how important it is for a husband not to be matil ema yaseira besoch beso. That a husband should not create an environment severe. Don't be overly disciplinarian and strict. Because essentially what happened was, there was a fly in his soup or something, and he used to get very angry. This lady apparently had a temper, and she was so distraught at his accusations that she ran away. So it was literally a situation of that. And the Gemara makes the point here that if a person is matil ema yaseira besoch beso, this could cause murder. As we find that this started the whole series of events that culminated in thousands and thousands of people dying. So Chazal see this as a lesson in terms of maintenance of domestic harmony.
Rabbi, she was called this Pelegesh. What was he to her?
What's the word?
Yeah, what's the word?
I don't know.
Well, Baal means husband, actually, in Yishuv means husband.
Yeah. I don't know if he has any term. I don't think there's any term that he has, because essentially it's a relationship without any obligations on his part. I mean, it says ish, but ish is not used here in terms of vis-a-vis her. It's just used to mean a man. I don't think there's any corresponding term. You mean just leaving the house? You mean deserting the household?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure there is. She's called, this is a whole sugya in the Gemara, she's called a moredes. A moredes is the rebellious wife. Now, a husband could be called a mored also. In other words, someone who deserts the relationship is in violation of halacha. And the sanction of moredes, I mean, the Gemara says, a moredes, the sanction would be this. If a woman, let's say, would just desert her husband, refuse to be in the house with her husband, unjustifiably, okay, that would have to be determined. So the sanction was that originally she would lose a certain amount of her ksuva every week. You deduct the ksuva for every week that she's gone. Or according to the other interpretation, you would wait 1 year, and for 1 year you wouldn't have to support her. She'd be given 1 year without any marital support, but if she goes back to her father, she might be happy with that. But at the end of the year, she gets a get and no ksuva.
That's like the reverse of the RCA.
Yeah. You know, well, that's right. Well, yeah, but that's because the issue that I'm talking about is where she refuses to cohabit with her husband. Mm-hmm. If the husband does it, you would add on to the ksuva, something like that. That's also give a moreid and a moredis. One of the difficult issues that comes before rabbinical courts today is, you know, if one side abandons, because very often, I mean, this is true even in secular domestic relations law, when one person abandons, leaves the house, even though that person may have left, but it could have been precipitated by all sorts of behaviors of the one that stayed. So in halacha and in law, we regard the precipitator as the one who abandoned the house. That's called constructive abandonment. The one who actually leaves is not always the one who's called the abandoner or the deserter. The deserter might be the one who created a situation in which the family was unlivable.
So why then, when there are divorce cases pending, that women are always advised, no matter how bad it is, don't leave the house?
Because then they're going to have to prove it. In other words, when someone leaves the house, it's very easy to say, you're the deserter. And then it's hard for her. She'll have to prove, well, I did it because of the A through Z. But if you're not the deserter, so you have that. It's an easier case, as it were.
Okay.
Okay, so the pasuk says v'tizna pilakshay, she either committed adultery or she just left him, and it says v'telech niito el beis aviyah, she went back home to her father, el beis lechem Yehuda, v'tehi sham yamim arba chadashim, she stayed there for 4 months. So he didn't even look for her for 4 months. He figured, okay, but after 4 months he was beginning to miss her. So it says v'yakam isha. Actually, this is here. It does say Isha. Yeah, it calls her Isha. It calls her husband. Yeah, yeah. Vayelech.
Actually, when it talks about him and how he perceives himself. He perceives himself as the husband.
In truth, it is important. The two words for husband are different. There's Ish and there's Baal. And you find very much that Ish is the much more affectionate term. Hashem says there will come a time when you will no longer, tikri li ishi, you will call me your ish, Hashem says, v'lo sikri od ba'ali, you will not call me your math, ba'al, although we use it for husband, really means master. So it's interesting, when it says isha, now this might be his perception of the picture.
Because with Palti ben Laish,
right.
At first it says ish, and then it says v'yelech achareha isha.
Right.
His perception was that he was upset about this whole thing, the isha is also when he went after her.
Right.
The same
that
term.
Could be. In other words, since he put, again, this might be the pattern. If we look at it, like the Gemara describes him as kind of an abusive husband in a sense. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, he abused her, she runs away, but then all of a sudden he gets very tender and loving and says, you know, let me go back, I'm the isha, come back to me. I mean, that's the pattern. They become extremely affectionate afterwards. So the yelech achrela daber aliba, again, it's kind of a romantic term to kind of entice her, speak words that go to her heart and bring her back. Lahashiva, to bring her back to him. The nairaima, he brings a young servant with him. Vitsemet chamorim, with a pair of donkeys, I guess one for him, one for her. Vativieu beisavia, and they were brought to her father's house. Vayireu avia nara. Now it's interesting. Now nara normally is a term that is used for a young girl, really below 12 and a half. So, but I'm not sure. Nara is sometimes used for anyone that's young, but it might refer to the fact that she in fact was not much more than a child. Vayismach likrasa, and the father was very happy to see him. But we'll see exactly if that's sincere. Vayechazik bo chosno. See, he calls him father-in-law. And the father-in-law held on to him, like embraced him. Avi hanara. Vayeshevito shloshes yamim. So he came to pick up his wife, but the father-in-law makes him, let's stay for a while. And he stays for 3 days.
She actually brought him into the house. He was
that's right.
Of the house,
but to she brought him into her father's house. Right.
He was outside, and she brought him in.
Right. Yeah, I see over here that he brings the redak that says the husband encountered her outside of the house and they made up. After they made up, she then brought him into her father's house. Vayochlu, vayishtu, they ate and they drank, vayolinu sham, and they slept there overnight. 3 whole days. So now it's the 4th day, the morning of the 4th day. Vayhi biyom harivi, the husband finally wants to get home. So vayashkimu baboker, he gets up in the morning. Vayokum lalechas, he's ready to go. Vayomer aviha nara el chasano. So the father of the girl says to his son-in-law, Genesis, may use that word because he's trying to endear himself to this man. Sa'ad libcha paslechem, satiate your heart by eating some bread. This is the same lashon that Abraham uses with the angels. Sa'adu libchem, achar teleichem. But afterwards you can go. This is the 4th day. So they spend another day. They eat together. They drink. The woman is not mentioned here. And then the man says to the ish. Now here, well, okay. I think
Naomi points out that he's an ish chashuv, and therefore the father wanted to ingratiate him. He didn't want any stigma left on his daughter.
Right.
The more he ingratiated him, the more he accepted her. He proved that this wasn't an adulterous relationship.
Right. That could be. I hear what you're saying. I mean, it could also be this, that at this point, for the first 3 days, there was like the affection that you have for your son-in-law. If you like your son-in-law, in other words, a good relationship. And now already, the man wants to go. The man wants to go. And the father-in-law is kind of forcing him. I mean, he doesn't do it coercively, but he kind of says, I want you to stay. And now it's already ish. The friendship is beginning to wear a bit thin. But nevertheless, he says, Halil na avalin, please stay here overnight. This is on the fourth day of Yitav Libecha, and your heart will be satisfied. V'yokam v'shalechas, the man wants to go already. It's the fourth day. V'yiftzar bo chosno, and the father-in-law presses him and pushes him and pressures him. V'yasha v'yalinsha. So he finally stays another night. So now it's the fifth morning. V'yashkein v'abaykir b'yom ha-chamishi l'olechas. V'yomra v'hanara, so he has the same line. Sadna l'vavecha. Eat, stay another day, vismamo, wait ad natosayom till after the noon. Natosayom is when the sun is going towards the west. Natos is, it's leaning towards the west. Wait till after the noon. V'yochlu shneyim. Now, why he wants him to stay could be different things. One thing would be that this was a public embarrassment for the man from Beis Lechem Yehuda, that his daughter's marriage or Pilegish relationship is breaking up. So as you say, he wants to show his friends and his neighbors that everything is great. We have this fine, wonderful relationship. The other possibility might be that he's trying to hold on to his daughter. The other possibility is he does not want his daughter to go with this guy, and he keeps on pushing it off until there's a confrontation. So there are two opposite ways of looking at what he is trying to do. But anyway, the man finally, after eating, the man gets up with the pilegesh and everything else, and the father-in-law makes one final claim. Rafa hayom la'arov. The day is getting dimmer, like rafa rifayon is weakness. The day is getting dimmer la'arov towards the erev. This is very unusual lashon, but rafa hayom la'arov. Linu la, please stay here. Don't travel at night. Hine chanos hayom. Behold, the day is camping. Right, the day is setting down, is ending. Lin po v'yitav levavecha. Vishkamtem machor l'darkechem. Get up tomorrow morning. V'halachta le'olach. You can go to your home. But the pasuk says, so remember, this is towards the evening. It's still daylight, but it's towards the evening on the fifth day. V'layavo ha'ish lalun. The man doesn't want to stay. V'yakam v'yelech, and he leaves. V'yavo ad nochach yivus. Remember, again, if you've been there, so you know where Beis Lechem is in relationship to Yerushalayim, not too far. So they begin traveling, and they arrive adjacent to the city of Yavus, which is none other than Yerushalayim. Remember, we've read a number of times that Yerushalayim was not conquered, at least some of it was not conquered in the time of the Shoftim. Some of it wasn't conquered till David's time, and certainly at the beginning of the period of the Shoftim. None of Yerushalayim was conquered, and it is called the Ir Yavusi. Now, again, there are a lot of discussions here. Some say that because, you know, Yavusi is one of the seven nations, they were inhabiting Yerushalayim, and Yoshua was unable to conquer it. But Chazal have a tradition that although it's called Yavus, the inhabitants were actually Pelishtim, the Philistines. And when it says that the reason the Philistines were allowed to live in Yerushalayim is because Avraham had made a Shavua to Avimelech, remember when they were passing through Geror, and Avimelech took Sarah thinking it was Avram's sister, and when she wasn't, and they were cursed, so he made Avram enter into a covenant of peace. And the promise was, Im tishkar li ulanini ulanechti, that you will not act deceitfully with me, my son, or my grandchildren. This was a mutual covenant. And it is said that in the time of the Shoftim, the Neched shel Avimelech, the grandchildren of Avimelech, were still living in that city, and therefore that city, in effect, or at least some of it, remained immune from attack. Okay, now Yerushalayim, of course, keep in mind that Yerushalayim was known to be a holy city by the Jewish people and by others as well, even when it was under non-Jewish domination and control. Shem ben Noach was Malchi Tzedek, the Melech Shalem, the King of Shalem, who, after Avraham was victorious in his war against the four kings, brought Avraham Lechem and Yayin, and it mentioned Shem ben Noach, Malchi Tzedek, was Kohen Lekel Elyon, was the priest, as it were, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It was known that Adam HaRishon was created from the dirt. That is on Mount Moriah, Har Moriah. The Akedas Yitzchak occurred at that place. That was certainly a holy place. And you'll see an interesting point that there's an implication that Jews were allowed to go into Yerushalayim. It's a very interesting notion. In other words, it was not a hostile situation. You'll see in the next verse, because the Nar actually suggests to his master, why don't we spend the night in the Ir HaYavusi? And the master said, I don't feel very safe. But there was an implication that a Jewish person would be able, at least officially, to get lodging in the university. That actually lends very strong to support to Chazal. See, according to Chazal, the pshat was, it was not that they couldn't conquer Yerushalayim because of the military might. If that was so, how could you think, let's have lodging in the Yerushalayim? It's like saying, let me go to the enemy. But if I say that in fact there was no state of war, but rather because of the covenant they couldn't wage war, so there was a de facto peace treaty for that time, so it's possible for somebody to say, well, let's go there. And in effect, the master says, well, that's a dangerous neighborhood anyway. I don't feel so comfortable being with the Philistines, even if we have some type of formal treaty. So actually, I think it's a very strong proof to the way Chazal understand the question of the Ir HaYavusi. I think I mentioned before, I'll just remind you again, that Yerushalayim is actually a contraction of two places. The original name was Shalem, which means peace or perfection. And that is Malchut Tzedek, the king of Shalem. And the other is Yirah. Yirah was the name that Avraham gave Mount Moriah because of the Akedah, when he said, V'yikra Avraham Makamu Hashem Yirah, that Hashem will see us, Hashem will watch us from this place. Asher Ye'amer Hayom, and today we call it Bahar Hashem Yeroah. This is where God can be perceived. In other words, Yerushalayim was the place where God watches and protects us, and where Hashem Yeira'eh, Hashem may be seen, not seen physically, but perceived and understood by us. In fact, the Mefarshim say a beautiful pshat in that pasuk. They say, Hashem Yeira'eh is always its name. God always watches us and protects us. But do we perceive God? We often don't. So it says, Asher Ye'amer Hayom, it will be said, when that great day comes, that's Bayomahu Yiyah Hashem Echadish Marachad, not only does Hashem see us, but Hashem Yeira'eh, we can perceive God's activities in history as well. So the truth is, the two names of the city are Yira'ah and Shalem, and the Aleph and He, Yira'ah, Yud Reish Aleph He, Aleph He equals Vav. So Yiru is a shortened form of Yira'ah Shalem. And that's why in Tanakh, it's almost every place, it might even be every place, Yerushalayim is always spelled without a Yud after the Lamed, because where the Yud comes from, I don't really know. But the original name is Shalem, so it's Yerushalayim. Now here, although we do read it, now here, Yerushalayim. Yeah, here we also have a Chirik, but there doesn't seem to be a Yud. The Yud was also added later. It could be the Yud is just the remez of having God's name, because it might be, now that I'm thinking about it, because Yechezkel says in his prophecy that the future name of Yerushalayim shall be Hashem Shama. Hashem is there. So it could be that the extra Yud, so you have two Yuds in Yerushalayim, which is Hashem is the city, but that's a later thing. And throughout Tanakh, it's always without a Yud. Okay, so yeah.
I have a question about Malki said, like you say he was Shem.
That's Chazal's tradition.
Okay. And you mentioned that he was a Kohen Lashem.
Right.
Was he a believer in monotheism?
Absolutely.
So then why is Abraham being given credit for bringing monotheism?
Well, first of all, you know, we've heard of the great yeshiva that Shem and his grandson Eber had, where Avram had learned and Yaakov had learned. Right? The answer was it's a good question. Essentially, the reason was because Avram was the one who spread God throughout the world. Shem basically felt like Noah. The world was evil. You kind of have to withdraw and create your small little circle. No, it's true, but the concept was, the difference is, do you kind of establish your place and people have to seek you out, or do you go and bring others? So Avraham's greatness was that he was someone who went out and taught people who would otherwise not approach him. For example, the people who came to his house for hospitality were idol worshippers. They were not coming to Avraham to learn about Hashem, but Avraham would teach them about Hashem. Hashem was the idea that if you wanted to come and learn about Hashem, he would teach you, but he was not an outreach.
Did Jews have an obligation to go to somebody who lives in a Avodah Zarah and teach them?
Yeah, we actually do. The Rambam says that Jews have an obligation to further the observance of the seven commandments of Noah among the Umos HaOlam. And among them, of course, are monotheism and everything else. That actually is very relevant on issues like abortion. Because, you know, you could take the position, why do I care about what the secular law about abortion is? We'll do what's right. But according to this, there is an obligation, as it were, to try to further observance of the seven commandments of Noah, among which is a prohibition against abortion, because among non-Jews, that is treated as part of the prohibition against killing.
It's stricter, that's right.
If a non-Jew commits an abortion, it is treated like a murder, which is not true for a Jew, where abortion is usher, but it's not true.
What is
the
rationale behind that?
Well, the rationale is, the truth is, that every violation of the seven mitzvahs b'nei Noach, if a guy steals, he's chayav mitzvah. So,
what is the rationale behind making it?
It seems to be that there was a fear that non-Jewish societies would have less sensitivity to life. And unless you really throw the book at them, other things would happen, etc. Jews would be, these would be the Torah would give us a sense of not going, not abusing the privilege, as it were. Okay, but look at this, it's very interesting. It's a fun evening. And they're passing by the city of Yavus, which is Yerushalayim. Haim im ha-Yavus, and they're right next to the Yavusi. V'hayom rad miyod, and the sun is going down, or the day is going down. V'yomer ha-nar al-adonav, and the young man says to his master, L'chonav and asur elir ha-Yavusi hazos. Let's go to the city of Yavusi. Let's go to Yerushalayim. Again, as I said before, it would be a strange type of picture if this is a hostile enemy city. And the man says, I don't want to do it. Lo nasur elir nachri. I don't want to go to it. He doesn't see these are our enemies. He says, I don't want to go to a city of the non-Jew, asher lo mibnei Yisrael hema, who are not Jewish, because I don't know what reception they will give us, and I might be harmed. Again, you see the irony. He wants to avoid Yavusi because he figures that's a dangerous neighborhood. Instead, let's look for a Jewish city. And of course, what's going to happen there, will be no better than what would have happened in Yavusi, presumably. Vayomer lenaro leich v'nikreva sorry biachad hamakamos. Let us come near one of the places. V'lanu bagiva oberam. Again, they're going north, right? They're going from Beis Lechem, Yerushalayim, going north. North of Yerushalayim is the chelak of Binyamin. Binyamin had a variety of cities due north of Jerusalem. Giva is one of them. Ramah is another one. Ramah, of course, is well known as the city of Shmuel. Later, this is Shmuel's own city. It's very interesting, I'm not sure if this is intentional. It's like Shmuel might be putting in a plug. Shmuel wrote the book of Shoftim. Might be putting in a plug for his city, because he mentions the man had a choice to go to Giva or Ramah. You know, too bad he didn't choose Ramah. He chose Giva because everything happened in Giva.
Why are they doing that? They're going from, I see.
He has to go back to Har Ephraim.
Right.
Har Ephraim is north.
He's from here, and he's going this way.
He's going this way, right. Okay. All right.
It's first, if you look at it anyway.
Right.
Geva and Giva are the same.
Sometimes it's spelled without a head. Of course, Giva literally just means hill. But sometimes it's Geva, sometimes it's Giva. I don't think it said. It didn't say what city. It says Yarkasei Har Ephraim. That means at the base of the Ephraim Mountains. So he was actually at the foot of the mountain. Okay. So Vayavro v'yelecho v'tavol avashamish. The sun comes down, and again, it was well known in those days you did not travel at nights. A night was, if you're not in a car or something, traveling at night is a very dangerous thing. And the sun comes down. Eitzel hagiva shel Binyamin. V'yasuru shem lavo lalun bagiva. And they turn to lodging giva. They figure somebody will take them, and there were no hotels. So essentially, if you were a stranger, you would wait until somebody saw you, and you would ask to have hospitality in their home. V'yavo v'yeshev b'rchof ha'ir. And the man sat down in the main street of the city. Nobody offers them hospitality. Apparently, it doesn't say there were no people there. Apparently, there were people there, the implication is. And nobody offered him any hospitality. They ignored him. An old man walked by. Again, this is emphasizing his sitkas, because number one, if he's old, that means he's probably weaker or feebler. And yet, he is the one that offered the hospitality. Although apparently he wasn't too old, he was still working. He came from finishing his work in the fields. So again, Shmuel Anavi is very emphatic. Yes, there was one man who was hospitable in Gibeah of Binyamin, but he was not from the tribe of Binyamin. Ironically, he was just like this person. He actually, of course, he lived in Gibeah now. He was not a traveler. He lived in Gibeah, but his origin was in Har Ephraim. The Anshei HaMakom, but everybody else in the city, Bnei Yamini, were Binyaminites. Vayisa Eina V'yaris Isha Reich Berchot, he saw the man that is a lodger in the street. V'yomer Isha Zakin Ana Telech, where are you going? What are you, Umayayin Tavo, where do you come from? V'yomer Eilav, speaking for him and his Nar. Ovrim, actually his wife should be with him too. It's interesting that she seems to be not mentioned here for a while. But so V'yomer Eilav, it could be, maybe he put his wife in a shelter there, maybe under a in a concealed place so she could rest or something. It's not really clear. He's waiting in the street where people could see him, and maybe she was moved. And he says, "Ovrim anachnu mi Beis Lechem Yehuda agarkasei Har Ephraim." We are traveling from Beis Lechem Yehuda to the foot of Mount Ephraim. Misham anochi, that is where I am from. Va'elech ad Beis Lechem Yehuda, I just traveled to Beis Lechem Yehuda. V'yes Beis Hashem ani holech. Unusual expression, and we're not even sure if it's true. I am going towards the house of God. Now, the house of God refers to the Mishkan that is presently located in Shiloh. And Shiloh is indeed in the area that was given to Mount Ephraim, Har Ephraim. But it's interesting that he essentially is going home. So why does he say, I'm going, Beis Hashem? Presumably, he may want to bolster his credentials, as it were. And I'm not just anybody. I'm somebody who lives in relatively close proximity to the Beis Hashem, and therefore I'm deserving of a certain amount of respect and deference. And the Ein Ishma Sefer Si Abaisa, nobody's taking me home. And then he emphasizes, I'm not going to be an economic drain. I have all my food and my provisions. Gam Teven, Gam Mispo, Yeshlecha Morenu. Our two donkeys have straw. The Gam Lechem V'Yayin Yeshli. I even have bread and wine. V'Lam Osecha V'Lanarim Avadecha. And the maidservant, which is his pilegesh, and the young man, im avadecha, that is with your servant, me, in other words. He's calling himself avadecha, that your maidservant, the young man, together with me, your slave, ein machsor kol davar, nothing is missing. And the Ish Zaken says, what do you mean? You don't have to take care of yourself. Shalom lach, things will be well for you. Rak kol machsor cho alai, I will take care of you. Rak birchov al tovim. Okay. So we have a very hospitable, generous man that's bringing them in. V'yavieu lebeiso, he brought them in. V'yaval lechamorim, and he fed the donkeys. V'yirchatsu raglayim, they washed their feet, just like Abraham used to wash people's feet. V'yochlu v'yishtu, they ate and they drank. So far so good. Now the Ramban points out, if you read the next verses, which will describe what Binyamin did, you see very, very close phraseology to stone. That and the Ramban draws the parallel, and it's obvious not just from the story, but from the lashon. I mean, the wording is almost exact. Where you find just like when Lot takes in the two angels, thinking that they're people, the city of Sodom comes around and demands, turn them over to us so that we can engage in basically mishkav zachar, homosexuality. And ironically, just like Lot says, "Don't take my guests. Here are my two daughters," which to us seems kind of a perversion. This is okay, who is described as a very generous, kind man, one would think, makes the same offer. And you see the parallel. We'll discuss the justification or the lack of justification for that. Hema meitivim es liba. They are making their heart feel good. V'hine yishir anshei b'nei b'liyal. People of the city, anshei b'nei b'liyal. B'liyal means evildoers. It comes from two words, b'li'ol, those who have no yoke of heaven upon them. Nasabu es habayis, this is the exact phrase that it says by Sodom. They turned and surrounded the house. Mistapkim al hadelas, they are pounding on the door. Vayomru al ho'ish bal habayis hazakein lame, when they say to the old man, Hotsei es ho'ish. Now the difference was, they asked for the anashim because there were two men. Here, for some reason, they're not bothering for the nar, and they're not asking for the pilagesh. They're saying, give us the man, v'neidana, that we will know him. And this is always used. Again, this is the exact lashon. It refers to Mishkav Zachar. Vayetze alem o'ish balabayis, just like Lot, came out of the door. Vayom alem al achai al tareyu. Lot said, al no achai tareyu. But it's the same thing. My brethren, do not do evil to these. No acharei asher bo'ed beisi. This man has come to my home. Al tasu es hanavala hazos. Do not do this despicable thing. Hine, biti hapsula. Behold, I have my virgin. Now Lot had two daughters. Lot offered two daughters. This man only has one daughter to offer. But there's another woman in the house. He has a pilagesh, the pilagesh. It's interesting that the guy that seems to be scot-free is the nar. The nar they're forgetting about. Because he came with a youth. He says, I'll give you my daughter who's a virgin, upilaksheyo, and this man's pilagesh, otsiana osa. Okay, we don't have to, I'll go over the explanations next week. I just want to get you, I want you to see the basic story here. Otsiana osam, I will give them out to you, vi'ino osam, and you may afflict them. He says, you may torture them if you want. V'yasu lahem hatov bi'einechem, and do whatever you want to do. But the yish hazeh, but to this man, my guest, Al tasu devar hanavala hazos. I mean, you see already, I mean, again, I'll get into the details next week, but you see already the almost the screwy morality that's going on here, where you have this tremendous achnasas orchim, this tremendous consideration for the man, and then we say to your daughter, the pilegesh, do what you want, but my guest you cannot harm. He's a guest in my house. And the pasuk says that the Binyaminites were not satisfied with this. So the man is coming out. So the man pulls his pilegesh with him. He says, well, if I'm going, you're going to be in this with me. So the pshat is, they didn't listen to the old man, and they wanted to take this man. So this man sends out his pilegesh instead of him. You talk about, you know, chivalry being dead. He sends out his pilagesh. Now, for some reason, it's not really clear. When the old man was offering, it's confusing just in terms of the narrative. When the old man was offering both his daughter and the pilagesh, it says they didn't want to listen. But when the man sends out his pilagesh, they take the pilagesh, and that's all they want to take. They didn't see her. In other words, he sent her out first. Uh-huh, that could be. Okay. The Yedu Osa, they had relations with her. The Yis'alaluba, now this is a very strong term, meaning they abused her. They sexually, it wasn't just one thing, but there was a raping and an abuse of her. Kol ha'layla ad ha'boker. The whole night, they were abusing her. Vayishalchuhu bi'alos ha'shachar. They sent her away. It was kind of, they just threw her away in the morning. Vatavo ha'isha lifnos boker. And towards the morning, after being abused the entire night, Vatipo Pesach Beso Ish. You know, she wants to go back to her father. The old man that took them in. And she comes by the doorway. Asher Adonah Hasham. Here you see very clearly it uses the word Adonah. Very significant. Adonah is the relationship of a master to a slave. Because at this point she realizes that she was just a piece of property and there was no feeling here. So it's called Adoneha, not Bali, not Ishi, not all that stuff. Shamad Boker. In other words, he seemed to have gone to sleep. Because he gets up in the morning, he's ready to go. Vayakam Adoneha Baboker. The Adon, the master, gets up in the morning. Vayiftach Dalso Sabayas. He opens the door. Vayetzel Lachas Adakri. He's about to leave. Now, he's about to go on his way. Does that mean that he was going to leave without her? Or he figured she would find her way back to him? It almost seems he was going to leave without even bothering with her. V'nei ha'isha pilagesho nofeles pesach habayis. His pilagesh has fallen. She's basically too weak to move. She collapsed by the entrance of the house. V'yadeh al-asaf, and her hand is holding on to the doorpost. She tried to enter the house, and she just collapsed at that point. V'yomer eleha, and the man says to her, Kumi v'nelecha, get up and we can go. Get up and you can go. Just amazing. V'yein ona, and she does not answer. V'yikachar al-achamor, so he puts her on the donkey. He loads her like a sack. V'yakam o'ish v'yelech l'mkamo, and they go back home. Okay. She died. Again, it doesn't say specifically she died, but as you see from the next verse, she died. The Ramban wants to say, well, she didn't die from the raping, she died from the exposure to the cold afterwards. And the Ramban wants to say that technically the people of Binyamin were not Chayav Misa, they did not murder her. Yeah, so he wants to create various halakhic technicalities in which they did not murder her. We'll discuss it more detail. But again, I mean that essentially does not excuse what's going on here. So what does he do? So then he has this dead body. For Yavo El Beso, he goes to, when he gets home to Har Ephraim, he is so outraged at what the Binyaminites did to his Pelegus, although he was the one who gave the Pelegus to them, that he wants to do something horrendous that will stir up the anger and wrath of all Bnei Yisrael, that they should wage war against these evildoers. So it says he takes a knife, a machelis. Again, very reminiscent. The word machelis is not used very often, but it's used for the Akedas Yitzchak. It's as if, in other words, it seems to me that Shmuel is trying to communicate that this man thinks he's doing a noble thing, which he isn't, but in his mind it's like he's the machelis doing the Akeda. He takes the body of his Pilegesh, Vayinat Chehalat Sameha. He cuts through the bone, he cuts her body up into Shnei Masai Nisachin, 12 pieces. And he sent one piece to every tribe. Now again, there's actually a machlokas, 12, because if he did not send it to Binyamin, where do you get the 12? So you have to count Levi. Although Levi is normally not involved in war. So some say he sent the chelik to Levi, and some say he sent the chelik to Binyamin as well, because we will find that what Bnei Yisrael wanted was that Binyamin should punish the wrongdoers themselves.
Right,
that's right. And only when Binyamin failed was there war. So first he sends it to the leadership of Binyamin that they themselves should execute. In fact, the Ramban basically says, drawing the parallel to Saddam, the Ramban does point out the fundamental difference. So we'll see in the pasuk that by Saddam it was the entire city that was engaged in this cruelty. And this was a small number. This was not necessarily, while it was true that the entire city of Geva seems to have been inhospitable, which is an Aveira, but this concept of surrounding the bias and engaging in abuse was really a small group of people. And therefore it is different than Saddam. But anyway, but he did send this this piece of her body. Fahaya kal haraya. Anyone that saw this, Amar said, Lo niyasa, there never was such a thing. Velo nirasa, we've never seen such a thing. From the day that the Jewish people left Mitzrayim, Adiyam, this was the worst thing we've ever seen. Simu lachem ala utzu v'deiru. Let us get together in council and see what to do. In the next parak, we'll talk about what they wanted. So next week we'll continue this. I just want to talk about exactly what the pshat was and how do we possibly understand what this is. But again, it is not to be sugarcoated. In other words, the pasuk Shmuel Anavi is trying to tell you what type of world you have when it's Ish Kol HaYashar B'Yena. And unlike the David and Bathsheba incidents where Chazal really tried to show you it really wasn't adultery, David, in other words, a get, there is an explanation. There isn't that much of an explanation here. I mean, you're really dealing with real breakdowns at that point without a spiritual leadership. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.